And hello, Sun Sounds listeners. This is Andy Bobbick, which means, once again, it's time for the Children's Story Hour. And as always, I'm glad you could join me today for a good variety of children's stories. Like always, the first half hour, I'll be reading picture books. And then the second half hour, I'm going to continue reading the novel that I've been reading now for about 5 weeks, titled Jack's New Power, Stories from a Caribbean Year. But first, let's begin today's program with the picture book titles. I'm going to start off with a book titled The Boy in the Big Blue Glasses. And then it's I Want to Eat My Brother, Willow and the Wedding, A Taste of Home. Foods from around the world are waiting just around the block. Seamus's short story. And if we have time, I'll finish up the first half hour with Grandpa's Cigar Box. So it should be a lot of fun. Let's get started with our first picture book today, titled The Boy in the Big Blue Glasses. I don't want glasses. My parents say that I look very handsome in them. I don't want to look very handsome in them. They make the backs of my ears hurt. Grandma's surprised when she sees me. Who's that handsome boy in the big blue glasses? It's me, Sammy. It can't be. You're so handsome. Grandpa is very surprised, too. He asks who the superhero with the glasses is. It's me, Sammy. Grandpa smiles. Well, there's a new superhero in town. Auntie Tori comes over, and she doesn't know who I am at all. Where's Sammy? I can only see this handsome boy. Then I tell her it's me. She's very excited. My parents make me wear my glasses to school. Miss May, my teacher, stares at me. She can't recognize me either. Who's this handsome boy? I don't even tell her it's me, Sam. No one sees who I am anymore. Miss May makes a huge announcement to the class. Please come out to the front, Sam. I shuffle my feet. Can anyone see what's different about Sam? But I'm not different. My stomach feels very sore. George, my best friend, puts up his hand. Sam's got glasses. He looks very handsome in them, says Miss May. They'll make Sam see everything really well now. I feel so sad. No one knows me anymore except for George. We build a pirate ship out of cardboard boxes. George walks the plank and falls into the sea. A shark nearly eats him, but I save him. Dad picks me up from school to go to the eye doctor. What did you do at school today? Miss May told the whole class I have glasses. Oh, that's very good, Dad says. No, it's very bad, because now no one knows who I am. I don't want to go to school anymore. The eye doctor checks my glasses. He makes them looser, so the backs of my ears aren't sore anymore. Does that feel good, Sam? No, it doesn't. I leave my glasses at the eye shop, but Dad finds them. I push them under my bed, but Ma finds them. I hide them in my lunch locker, but Miss May finds them. Ma gets a special case for my glasses and puts them in a special place at the front door, so I won't forget to wear them. She sticks a picture of Superman on the case, too. Yes, but no one recognizes Superman when he wears his glasses. Doesn't Ma know that? Then the worst thing happens. George is sick. He doesn't come to school. I have no one to play with. Everyone stares at me. They don't know who I am. Miss May won't let me take off my glasses. I sit by myself. A mean girl pokes my arm and calls me Fish Eyes. Her friends giggle. Then a boy puffs up his cheeks and pretends to be a pufferfish. I don't cry because I'm a superhero. I take out a cloth from my glasses case to clean my glasses. I don't really want to clean them, but I don't want to be fish eyes. That's when my classroom becomes a blur. I sit there squinting at Miss May, who looks like a giant penguin. I squint at the girl who poked my arm. She looks like a googly-eyed turtle. I make a face like a googly-eyed turtle and start to laugh. She pokes me again, and I laugh harder. Then her friend starts to laugh. I puff up my cheeks at the pufferfish boy, and he starts to laugh. Then everyone is laughing. Miss May turns around, her flippers flapping in the air. I put on my glasses, and she changes into Miss May again. She's laughing too. Sam, 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 you're so funny. When George comes back to school, we play on our pirate ship made out of cardboard boxes. George walks the plank and falls into the sea. The googly-eyed turtle and her friend fight off the shark that nearly eats George. I chase the pufferfish boy to the top of the pirate ship, and we climb the mast. And guess what? Everyone can see me. I want to eat my brother. Spinach? No way. Spaghetti? Forget it. Oscar can't stand them and doesn't regret it. He dislikes it all, from fries to shepherd's pie. Eating, says Oscar, is a pure waste of time. And these are all rabbits. What could we possibly put on his plate, his parents wonder. Would you eat a chicken breast? His father calmly suggests. How about some fruit snacks? His mother asks. Or some fried eggs? His father begs. We could even make you an orangutan steak. It was worth a try, his mother replies. Let's see, what about a strawberry dad cake? Or maybe a rutabaga is more to your taste. How about a giant soda pop lake? Chicken skewers? A peanut stew? Maybe you'd like a shrimp ragout. How about rat risotto? Or a canary dish to go? A steaming pot of escargot? A very berry cherry pie? Lego lasagna, so good you'll cry. Pickled bird brains that can fly. How about a sausage snowboard to steer for my little lettuce mountaineer? Or a breakdancing tortoise while the dishes are cleared? A seafood salad parade after supper, fish swimming in beer. That's amber colored. Three fat worms in garlic butter. No, says Oscar, I want to eat my brother. Eat your brother? I want to chomp his derriere, then gnaw his little knees. I'll take his head in both my hands and chew up his fat cheeks. Brothers aren't for eating, his parents exclaim. They're for hugging, kissing, and snuggling, doling up and pampering, giving bottles to, and cuddling. But Oscar, please, brothers are not for eating. Oscar disagrees. He'd be better off in my belly. In there, he wouldn't be as yelly. He wouldn't wake me up at night when he cries. And both of you would be all mine. I'm sure he's very tender and full of vitamins, too. And if I eat him, you'll see. I'll grow up bigger and taller than you. I'd love to eat him with the seafood parade after supper. I'd eat him with fish and beer. That's amber-colored. Even with 3 fat worms in garlic butter. But hear me when I say it, I want to eat my brother. Oscar's little brother looks up at him, eyes wide. Is the poor thing really scared and going to cry? It's really quite hard to read how he's behaving. Oh, it's a French fry that he's craving. Under the table, Oscar slips him a fry, a spoonful of spinach, a smidge of shepherd's pie, a tiny bite of his crisp green lettuce wrap, the rest of his spaghetti, and even his fruit snacks. Oscar's parents are pleased. Bravo, Oscar, you finished your plate. Oscar winks at his brother. Hey, little dude, want to come play ball? You're not so useless after all. I'll eat you up next time, fat cheeks and all. Willow and the Wedding. Willow hadn't slept much the night before. Uncle Ash was picking her up bright and early. They had a big day planned. Their first stop was the animal shelter. They delivered the toys and treats they had collected. They cleaned pens, gave baths, and played with the animals. They walked to the park, and Uncle Ash pushed William on the merry-go-round. They fed the ducks and raced down the slides. Afterward, they went to Squilly's for their favorite dessert, donuts. Uncle Ash and Willow had a lot in common. They loved animals, adventure, and art. They had the same curly hair, blue eyes, and one dimple each. They even shared the same middle name. But there was one thing they didn't share. Willow loved to dance. But when she tried to get Uncle Ash to join her, he was as stiff as Grandpa's cane. What's wrong? Willow would ask. I don't dance, was all he would say. Willow tried everything, but Uncle Ash wouldn't even tap his foot. Why doesn't Uncle Ash dance? Willow asked Mama one day. He used to, Mama said wistfully. Uncle Ash loved to dance, just like you do. And he was amazing. What happened? Willow asked. Well, Mama remembered. It was a long time ago. Uncle Ash got the lead role in the school musical. He was so excited, and he practiced every chance he had. On opening night, he danced his heart out, Mama said, but it didn't go the way he wanted it to. What do you mean? Willow asked. Well, the kids laughed at him. They called him Frankenstein and Twinkle Toes. And to make matters worse, Mama added, Grandpa wasn't there. He didn't think much of Uncle Ash dancing. Willow thought about Uncle Ash and how he must have felt when the kids laughed at him. She thought about Grandpa not being there and not wanting Uncle Ash to dance. Mostly, though, Willow thought about what Mama had said. Uncle Ash loved to dance. Uncle Ash and David came to dinner on Sunday. They had a special announcement to make. They were getting married. They asked Willow to be their flower girl. She pirouetted around the table. Yes, yes, yes. They talked about colors and candles and flowers. They showed William and Mama photos of the beach where they were getting married. And they talked about what they would serve for dinner and dessert. Donuts with sprinkles? Willow said, hopeful. Well, there's only one thing left, Mama said. Music. And dancing, Willow exclaimed as she grabbed Uncle Ash's hands and pulled him up to dance. But Uncle Ash didn't move. You have to dance. Well, I'm afraid that's not going to happen, Uncle Ash said firmly. Everyone knows I don't dance. Who will I dance with? David asked. Willow, Uncle Ash replied, Willow loves to dance. Well, a week later, Willow, Mama, and Uncle Ash went shopping for a flower girl dress. They picked out the most beautiful dress Willow had ever seen. After lunch and dessert at Squilly's, it was time for Willow's weekly dance class. Uncle Ash turned to leave, but Willow had a plan. Come with us, Uncle Ash. You can watch me dance. As the students stretched and chatted, Willow announced that her uncle was getting married. And then, to Uncle Ash's surprise, Willow told the class how he loved to dance when he was young. The music began to play. Uncle Ash watched Willow and the other children dancing and twirling and laughing. Without realizing it, he began to tap his foot, and before he could stop her, Willow pulled Uncle Ash to his feet. He felt awkward at first. He hadn't danced in years. Miss Sally led the children through the moves, and Uncle Ash followed along. They practiced leaps and twirls and plays. When the tempo picked up, they did the shuffle and the stomp. They did toe rises and jazz walks and attitude turns. Miss Sally and the class stopped and stared. Mama was right, Willow thought. Uncle Ash was an amazing dancer. The wedding day finally arrived. I've never been to a wedding like this before, Cousin Joe whispered to Sadie. Isn't it splendid, Willow said, giving them her most magical smile. I'm cold. Willow got Aunt Carol a warm beach blanket to put over her shoulders. I have sand in my shoes. You don't need shoes, Aunt Thelma, Willow said as she wiggled her toes in the soft, warm sand. It's hot out here. Willow filled a tall glass of lemonade for Uncle Larry. This will cool you off. When the bongo music started, Willow made her way down the aisle. Uncle Ash was beaming. At the end of the ceremony, the guests made their way to the reception. Dinner was delicious. Dessert was even better. When the DJ announced it was time for a special dance, Willow skipped to the dance floor. And when the music started, Willow reached out her hand and said, Uncle David, it's time to dance. No one was surprised to see Uncle Ash standing on the sidelines. Everyone knew Uncle Ash didn't dance. So when he walked onto the dance floor, everyone was surprised. What is he doing? They whispered. Uncle Ash winked at Willow. Then he took David's hand and began to dance. Family and friends were astonished at what they saw. Uncle Ash was a magnificent dancer. Willow twirled Uncle Larry onto the dance floor and jitterbugged with Aunt Thelma too, who was dancing in her bare feet. Sadie did the twist, and Cousin Joe showed off his disco moves. Aunt Carol was swept into Willow's conga line, joining the others on the dance floor. Even Grandpa found his beat. He had moves no one had ever seen, and a smile that wouldn't go away. It was easy to see where Willow and Uncle Ash got their love of dancing. And for the rest of the night, everyone enjoyed family, friends, and dancing, especially Willow and her two favorite uncles. A Taste of Home. Foods from around the world are waiting just around the block. A child of the city steps outside with an empty bag. His mother calls from the window, "Bring back a taste of home." Feet dance along familiar cracks in the sidewalk. Storefronts and street signs greet him like old friends. As he wanders, what is home? To him, home is this street he knows better than any other, where his family has lived for as long as he can remember. Home is a line of buildings rising like stone giants into the sky, a stately synagogue down the block, a kosher grocery store around the corner. But to his mother, home is also another place, where she lived when she was a child, far away yet close enough in memory. A land flowing with milk and honey. Because home is not only where you are, it is where you came from. And to children of the city, home is more than the landmarks of their neighborhood. A bogata guarded by a golden cat, a church with kaleidoscope windows, an indoor market with fruits and vegetables of every shape and color. Reminders of an island paradise their parents called home. And the sights and smells and sounds of here are like stories about there. A building with a pagoda roof, roast duck hanging in a restaurant window, shouts and laughter ringing through a crowded market, reflections of a vast country, half a world away. And home can change over time. The places we love might move or disappear, and new ones might replace them. A welcoming mosque, a row of restaurants, a grocery store stocked with spices and oils, warm comforts from a land of rivers. But maybe home is not a place at all. Maybe home is people who gather to share and celebrate. Children with roots in many places who come together to walk the streets of their city. So the child of the city brings his friends back to the street he knows so well. He greets street signs and storefronts. He dances along cracks in the sidewalk. He looks into his bag, now filled with taste of home, and realizes he never left home at all. Seamus's short story. There's no doubt about it, Seamus is short. And from where Seamus is standing, the world appears to be made for tall people. Tall people can reach things like elevator buttons to the top floor, the chocolate milk in the fridge, the shelf where Dad keeps the TV remote, and horrid pictures of themselves as babies. Seamus is desperate to find some way to get the things he can't reach. He tries a chair, but it's rickety. A stepladder, but it's wobbly. And running jumps, which are hit and miss. His brother's shoulders, but they are not quite high enough. He'd give his prized taxidermy collection to be tall. He'd give his pirate costume. He'd even give his two front teeth. Well, to be fair, they are loose anyway. One day, while playing dress-up in his mother's closet, Seamus finds a great way to reach new heights. He tries on his mother's high-heeled shoes. He stuffs them with socks. He tapes them to his ankles. He even decorates them with his favorite stickers. Seamus practices wearing the high-heeled shoes in the morning after school, and even when he is supposed to be in bed. Eventually, he is steady enough on his feet to go out into the world. When he wears his new shoes, he is able to reach the top button in the elevator, the chocolate milk in the fridge, the TV remote, and finally, he is able to take down that horrid picture of himself as a baby. He teeters from his bedroom to the kitchen. He totters from the kitchen to the yard. He trapezes from the yard to his neighbor's house and back again. Seamus is having a blast. He feels free. It is wonderful being tall, except that sometimes his feet hurt. Then one day he notices some things he wants way down below. A shiny quarter, a bouncy ball he thought he'd lost, a pack of gum in Mom's purse, a beautiful dandelion he would dearly love to pick for her. So now he must decide, up or down, high or low, tall or small. Seamus deliberates for a long, long time until he comes up with the answer. There are times to be tall, and there are times to be small. And that's the long and short of it. I'm going to finish up the first half hour of today's program with Grandpa's Cigar Box. In spring, when Jamie visits Grandpa's house, it smells like lilacs. Jamie runs into the living room and jumps on the sofa. "Hi, Grandpa. What's in my cigar box today?" She sniffs. Chocolate. A marshmallow bunny sits next to a package of flower seeds. "What are we going to do today?" Jamie licks her fingers. "Well, we're going to plant marigolds." They kneel in the garden and sprinkle the tiny seeds. "Let's water them." Jamie grabs the garden hose. Water sprays all over Grandpa. "Uh-oh, sorry, Grandpa."
"Oh, that's okay. Now I don't have to take a shower today."
In summer, when Jamie visits Grandpa's house, it smells like freshly mowed grass. Jamie leaps off the sofa. "Hi, Grandpa. What's in my cigar box today?" She lifts the lid. "Yum! Orange gumdrops and swimming goggles." "What are we going to do today?" Jamie smacks her lips. "Let's go swimming." Jamie climbs the ladder. "Whee!"
"Wow, you got me all wet," chuckles Grandpa.
Jamie laughs. "You're already wet. All you need is soap." In autumn, when Jamie visits Grandpa's house, it smells like pumpkin pie. Jamie plops on the sofa. "Hi, Grandpa. What's in my cigar box today?" She peeks in the box. "Oh, candy corn and wax lips." "What are we going to do today?" Jamie mumbles. "Let's carve a jack-o'-lantern." They scoop out the pumpkin seeds. "My hands are sticky, Grandpa." He fills the sink with water. Jamie climbs on a stool and smacks her hands. Water splashes on Grandpa. "Oops, sorry, Grandpa," Jamie giggles.
"There you go, giving me a shower again," Grandpa smiles.
In winter, when Jamie visits Grandpa's house, it smells like burning wood. "Where are you, Grandpa? Are you hiding from me?" She grabs a cigar box and runs down the hallway. She finds him in bed. "The cigar box is empty, Grandpa."
"I'm sorry, Jamie. I don't feel well."
"What are we going to do today?" Jamie frowns. Grandpa coughs. She taps the box. "I have an idea." She carries it into the kitchen and rummages through the cupboards. She carries it into the study and digs through the desk drawers. She fills a glass of water. When she returns to the bedroom, she lays the box on Grandpa's lap and gives him a glass of water. "Grandpa, open the cigar box."
"Oh, boy, candy canes, a coloring book, and crayons. My favorite. Thank you, Jamie."
"Let's color together," Jamie says. She whispers in his ear, "Grandpa, can I have one of your candies?"
"Of course you can,"
Grandpa hands Jamie a candy cane and spills the water all over Jamie. Jamie hugs Grandpa. Now I don't have to take a bath today. And this is just a reminder. My name is Andy Bombeck, and I hope you're enjoying the Children's Story Hour. And as I mentioned at the beginning of today's program, for the second half hour, I'm going to continue reading the novel that I've been reading now for about 3 weeks. That's titled Jack's New Power, Stories from a Caribbean Year. Jack Henry, the hero of Heads or Tails, Stories from the Sixth Grade, is back. It is the summer after sixth grade, and Jack and his offbeat family have relocated to the island of Barbados. Jack hopes he's escaping the craziness of his old life in Florida, but even in a Caribbean paradise, he is plagued by misadventure. He gets a violent case of blood poisoning and ends up painted purple from head to toe, discovers the perils of male bonding in a pepper-eating contest with his father, and has his heartstrings twanged by an older woman, his sister's best friend, to name just a few of his troubles. But in this 8 fierce and funny stories, Jack always perseveres, sometimes with the help of one of the few reliable things in his life, his trusty diary. Okay, last week I started a new story. We learned that Jack got food poisoning and was painted on the outside with purple medicine. Now Jack is worried he's not going to make any friends at all. So prior to that, Jack explained how their housekeeper chopped the head off a chicken, then let it run away. If he or his brother Pete caught it first, they could eat the heart fried in a pan. Jack caught it first. Jack has just returned to his bedroom, and that's where I left off last week. I limped over to my bookshelf and pulled down a large volume on table manners written by Amy Vanderbilt. I gave it a shake. It rattled inside like a drawer full of silver spoons. The title was printed in gold lettering. I wondered if I could scrape the gold off and sell it. I certainly didn't want to read about table manners. I already knew them all. Chew with your mouth closed, no burping, say please and thank you, don't blow your nose in your napkin. I sat down on the floor with the book across my lap and worked off the 3 rubber bands which held the covers and pages together. It's not that the book was worn out from use. Someone must have given it to us as a gift, because a book on table manners is not something Mom or Dad or even Betsy would go out and buy. They all knew that even if Pete and I read the book 100 times, we'd still chew food with our mouths open, prop our elbows on the table, and burp like pig men. This book was my toolbox. It was hollowed out inside. I opened it up and searched through the old tools I had stored within the carved-out pages. One day before we had left Florida to live in Barbados, Mom had come into my room with her industrial-strength vacuum cleaner. "I have something big to tell you," she said. I was suspicious. Any minute, I expected her to lunge at me with the vacuum nozzle and try to suck the wax out of my ears. "We're getting ready to move 2,000 miles away. Your dad got a new job in Barbados." I already knew this. Betsy had overheard them talking at night and had told me. "Well, I want you to know that we can't take everything we own. We all have to make some sacrifices. You can bring your clothes, your books, and your diaries, but not," and she waved the vacuum nozzle around the room, "all this junk. Candy wrappers, bottle caps, insects, newspaper clippings, and I mean it. So get rid of it, or I will." She turned and marched out of the room, leaving the vacuum behind as a threat. The first thing I did was open the vacuum cleaner and go through the dust bag. I had hidden a few dried bugs in Betsy's room, but since Betsy hadn't screamed and come after me with a shoe, I figured Mom had found them first and sucked them up. And sure enough, They were in the dust bag. I picked them out and blew the dust off their cracked skin. Then I slipped them into my top pocket. Mom and I had been fighting over my junk for a long time. She thought I was too old to collect stuff that she claimed had no meaning. But my junk meant everything to me. We had already moved about a dozen times, and I wouldn't have any souvenirs of where I had lived, who my friends and neighbors were, and what schools I went to, unless I saved a little bits and pieces of it. I had already learned how to save a lot of my flat junk by hiding it in my normal diary. I had stapled in my baseball cards, glued in my stamp collection, taped in my pennies, as well as my photograph collection, newspaper clippings, Chinese fortune cookie fortunes, postcards, and gum wrappers. But chunky stuff like rocks and shells and bottle caps and marbles was difficult. Then I had remembered a movie where a detective took a big, heavy book down from a library shelf and opened it up. Inside, the book was hollow. The middle of all the pages had been carved out, which left a big hole behind. Inside the hole was a bottle of poison. I didn't have poison, but I liked the sneaky hiding place inside the book. So I went out to the living room and took a bunch of old books that nobody ever read down from a shelf. Then I went out to the garage where Dad kept all his carpentry tools. With a wallboard knife, I cut out the middle of the pages. It was easy. Then I went back into my bedroom and began to fill the books up with all my junk. When it came to my tool collection, I carved out the inside of the fat Amy Vanderbilt book on table manners. When I finished, I put in my pliers, screwdriver, tack hammer, screws, nails, nuts, and bolts. That was 2 months ago. Now I took out the needle nose pliers. I had to perform surgery. Whatever I had stepped on throbbed like a bad tooth. When I held a mirror up to the bottom of my foot, I saw that it wasn't a thorn or a piece of glass. It was a plantar wart about the size of a tiny cauliflower. "Wow," I said when I saw it, "gross." I put the mirror down and touched it. "Ouch," I cried. I looked at the wart again. I couldn't believe something was growing on me, growing in me. What nerve! But it scared me. It was like something alien taking over my body, as though I might suddenly grow a second nose or a third ear. I couldn't let the wart take over my body. I grit my teeth and got a deep grip on it with the pointy tips of my needle nose pliers. "So long, Mr. Wart," I growled. "One, two, three." I squeezed down on the handles and yanked the wart straight out. I thought I heard something rip. For an instant, I felt relief. Then suddenly, the pain hit me like a hot needle jammed into my foot. "Ah!" I moaned and rolled over on my side. I held my breath and fought back the pain. "Mind over matter," I said to myself and pounded the floor. "Mind over matter," I repeated. But I was losing the battle. The pain roared back and blood squirted out of the hole just like it had squirted out of the chicken necks. I crawled over to my bed and pulled myself up by the headboard. "Oh, crap," I said. "Oh, crap." I hopped over to the door and opened it. I peeked down the hall. Betsy had her door closed, and no one else was in sight. I hopped on my good foot and leaned against the wall. Every now and then, my hurt foot touched the floor, and I nearly hit the roof. When I got to the bathroom, I locked the door. I held my foot over the bathtub spigot and turned on the water. Ah! It burned. When the blood slowed, I wrapped the hole with gauze from the first aid kit and taped it up. Suddenly, I heard Betsy shout, "What's this blood in the hall?" She pounded on the bathroom door. "Open up!" She tried the knob. "You know you're not allowed to lock the door." She pounded on it again. "Is this chicken blood?" "No," I shouted, and hurried to wipe up the blood in the tub with toilet paper and flush it down the commode. "Mom," she hollered. "Mom, come here." Then Mom was pounding on the door. "What's all this blood?" she asked. Now, Betsy's done it, I thought. I took a deep breath and opened the door. "I only yanked a wart out of my foot," I said casually. "I just put on a bandage. It's no big deal." "You're more disgusting than I thought," Betsy said, and twisted up her face into a warty shape. "Well, did you clean it out well?" Mom asked. "Yes," I replied. "Did you use peroxide?" she asked. "Yes," I said, lying. "Okay, then, just clean up the hall." "Disinfect it," Betsy added. "Use hot water. I don't want any voodoo wart seeds getting on my feet." "There is no such thing as a wart seed," I said. "Just look in the mirror," she cracked back. "Enough," Mom ordered. "Jack, clean the hall." "Okay," I moaned and hopped away like a lame rabbit. That night, my foot was killing me. I sat on my bed with a penknife and carved a little hole into the cover of my diary. When it was big enough, I removed a wad of tissue from my shirt pocket. I unwrapped the tissue and inspected the wart. I didn't want to touch it because of the wart seed idea. I didn't want a family of warts growing on my fingertips. I jabbed at the wart with the point of my knife, then pressed it into the hole with the handle. Just to be on the safe side, I stuck a piece of clear tape over its bumpy surface. It looked like something dead in a glass coffin. "Rest in peace," I whispered. I opened my diary and drew a rough map of our neighborhood over both pages. I wanted to make a list of all the people who might be my friends. I didn't want Betsy to beat me at making new friends. She was always boasting that she was more popular than I was because I was clueless on how to be a friend. But I knew more than she thought I did. Dad had taught me the rules. Being a good friend meant you were a good listener. Always told the truth about what you liked and disliked, and tried to lead by example, not by threats. And you had to know how to tell good jokes and stories. I knew he meant that telling good jokes and stories was not the most important part. The other stuff, he just said because it was his job to sound like a parent. I wanted to sneak up and down the street and locate the neighbors' names so I could write them on my map. But my foot hurt too much to creep around. I limped over to my French doors and stepped outside. I climbed the avocado tree until it was high enough to see down the street. I had my diary with me. It was dark and there were no street lights. Each house looked like a ship out on the ocean. I could only spot the houses by the light in their windows. Actually, I could hear more than I could see. It was so quiet that I heard a boy at one house ask his mother if he could have a bowl of ice cream. She said no. I wrote, "No ice cream house," down on my map of the neighborhood. I didn't know their names yet, but I knew I wouldn't be going there for dessert. Every time I needed to write something down, I had to strike a kitchen match and hold it with my left hand while I wrote with my right hand. When my fingertips started to get hot, I dropped the match inside the diary and smothered it. I watched a car turn the corner. It passed our house and stopped three houses down. A huge family piled out. They spoke loud, but I couldn't understand them. It sounded like Arabic. My grandfather was from Lebanon. He died before I was born, but Dad sometimes recited poems in Arabic, so I knew how their talk sounded. Once the car doors closed, it was pitch black. They all went inside their house, and room by room, lights appeared in the windows. I struck a match to make a note on my map. Arabs, I wrote. For a long time, nothing happened. From starting out into the shifting darkness, I got drowsy. I didn't want to fall asleep and pitch head first out of the tree and snap my neck. I had had enough pain for one day. I climbed down and went to bed. 3 days later, I woke up speckled with boils and blisters. Ah! I cried out in panic. Help! I'm sick! I'm dying! I went running to Mom. Oh my God, she said, horrified. Then she hollered for Dad. Jack, she yelled, come here quick. Dad took one look at me, made a disgusted face, and grabbed his car keys. Mom ordered me to get dressed and ran to her room. As I was putting on some clothes, I heard her talking to a receptionist at Bailey Clinic. It's an emergency, she said. We'll be right over. She was right. Dad drove like a maniac. Move it, you slugs, he kept shouting out of his window. He honked the horn the entire time, madly waved his fist, and nearly flattened a dozen people on bicycles. The building was like Dr. Frankenstein's laboratory. A nurse and a doctor were waiting for us. They rushed me into the examination room and told Mom and Dad to wait in the hall. The nurse made me lie down on a bed while the doctor injected a needle into my sores and withdrew samples of the pus and blood. He seemed very serious. Did you eat anything unusual? He asked and poked at my draining sores with a cotton swab. No, I replied. Any bug bites? No. Any plant allergies? No. He didn't ask about warts, and I didn't volunteer anything. At the end of the examination, he told me to stand up, and then he escorted me to the waiting room. I put a big smile on my face to keep Mom and Dad from going crazy, but inside, I was full of fear. Maybe Betsy was right, and I had some voodoo chicken plague. I'll call you tomorrow, he said calmly to Mom and Dad. I'll have some blood results by then. That night, I heard my parents talking about me. They were standing toe-to-toe in the dining room. I want to go home, Mom said. The nurse said it might be leukemia. What does she know? Dad said. If it was leukemia, the doctors would have said something. Well, I'd feel better if we were back in Florida. Forget Florida, Dad said. We're living in paradise. It's not paradise if you die here. Don't get carried away. He'll be fine. Let's just see what the tests show before we get too worked up. I don't want to take any chance on his health. We're not taking chances. You're getting hysterical. Mom's voice rose a full octave. Hysterical, she screeched. If the test results are bad, we're leaving. I didn't want them to catch me spying, so I hopped down the hall on my good foot. Now I've done it, I thought. I've ruined paradise. The next day, the doctor called us back to the clinic. Mom asked if I had leukemia. He smiled, no. It's just simple blood poisoning. Then he turned and stared directly at me. I felt my heart racing. I thought of that little chicken just before Marlene had lowered the machete, whack, and then she cooked him. Did you step on anything rusty? He asked. Mom's eyes widened. You did tell him about your wart, didn't you? No, I said to her. She rolled her eyes. Then I faced the doctor. Yeah, I pulled a wart out of the bottom of my foot with a pair of pliers. The doctor leaned forward and placed his hand on my forehead. He must have thought I had a fever and was talking nonsense. I looked over at Mom. She hunched down in her seat and covered her eyes with her hand. May I see your foot? The doctor asked. I pulled off my shoe, then my sock. He unwrapped the gauze bandage. Well, it doesn't hurt so much anymore, I said. He poked at it. It looks a bit angry, he replied. How clean were the pliers? Well, I found them on the street, I said. They were a little rusty.
I turned to Mom. She was staring at me in disbelief. Well, that would explain it. What you need are antibiotics for the infection and a gentian violet for the boils. In a minute, the nurse arrived with a big purple bottle. Please remove all your clothing, she said. She unscrewed the cap and poured the medicine into a shallow bowl. Then she put on a pair of rubber gloves and dipped cotton balls into the medicine. I took off my clothes and watched as she painted me purple from head to toe. Mom stood to one side and smiled. Betsy and Pete granged up to me. Every chance they had, they made fun of me. 2 days later, Mom had to reapply a fresh coat of purple paint. When I slinked out into the breakfast porch, Dad took pity on me. Well, you've got a choice, purple boy, he said, and rubbed the top of my head. Either we can go to the kennel and get a dog, or I can take you to the carnival. That was an easy decision. Carnival, I replied. Good choice, Betsy mumbled. There's no reason to scare man's best friend to death. Hey, give him a break, Dad said. It's not easy being purple. Well, it's not easy being seen with him either, she replied. Well, I'll be ready in a few minutes, I said. I retreated to my bedroom. Earlier, I had carved a foot-shaped pad of foam rubber out of my bed pillow. I taped it into my sneaker and tried it on. When I walked a little on the side of my foot, it didn't hurt at all. Okay, I said to myself, I'm making a comeback. Maybe I'll find a friend at the carnival. At the carnival, we played skill games. We threw hoops over bottles and shot at ducks and tested our strength. I didn't win anything. Too bad they don't have a chicken chasing contest, Betsy said when Dad stepped away to speak with a man who was working with him on the hotel renovation. You might win a stuffed wart. I glared at her. Just then, a booming voice came out of the overhead loudspeaker. Ladies and gentlemen, come into the Egyptian tent and see one of the seven wonders of the natural world. Come see and hear the incredible life of the alligator lady. She walks, she talks, she crawls on her belly like a slimy reptile. Let's go there, I said. I have a better idea, Betsy said. Let's put a tent around you. He's poxed. He's purple. He chases headless chickens like the purple freak he is. Come on, Pete, I said. Let's play some games. Forget it, he replied, and wrinkled up his face at me. He was definitely out of my control. Betsy had won him over. You'll be sorry you betrayed me, I said. Betsy will turn you into a priss. Come on, Betsy said and grabbed Pete's arm. Let's go look at the baby goats. They're so cute. See what I mean, I said. I waited until they were out of sight. Then I went to the baseball throw. The man running the booth eyed me suspiciously. I bet he wanted me to wear gloves. For some stupid reason, I had tears in my eyes. And when I threw at the bottles, I couldn't hit a thing. The first two balls missed by a mile. I threw the third so wide of the mark, I hit the operator's coffee cup. It flew off the table and smashed against a chair leg. Hey, he said, you're going to have to pay for that. Yeah, you'll have to touch me first, I shot back, then turned and ran. Being disgusting was good for something. I dodged a bunch of people as I cut down the path past game booths. Everywhere there were printed signs and posters of silly clowns and goony animals with crossed eyes and crazy costumes. I must have looked like one of them that came to life. A kind of diseased Pinocchio, I thought. I kept running and people kept stepping out of my way. I passed the bumper cars, the Ferris wheel, the spinning teacups, the centrifuge force machine. I felt like I could run forever. My foot didn't hurt at all. I wanted to run home. I just didn't know the way. When I slowed down, I didn't see anyone from my family.
I spotted the alligator lady tent and walked over to get a closer look. They charged $1, so I paid up and went in. It was dark, and I didn't seem so purple. Egyptian flute music was playing from a tiny speaker. There was a little stage with a grassy curtain and papier-mâché palm trees. In front of the stage, men were lined up about 3 deep. It was hot and smelly under the tent, like a swamp. A barker in a dirty white suit and pith helmet was explaining that the alligator lady was netted by Egyptian fishermen on the Nile. She's the cousin of mermaids. She is over 1,000 years old and has seen her husband killed by Napoleon's troops and turned into riding boots. The music speeded up. The curtain lifted, and a large woman in a reptile suit crawled out. I could see where the zipper had split down the side of her costume. She must have gained a little weight. A long alligator mask was strapped to her face with thick green elastic straps. They tried to disguise the phony suit by sticking a lot of slimy leaves and pond scum all over her. She crawled across the stage on her belly, like someone crawling under her bed. She peered up at the circus barker and hissed. "She's a fake," a man said. "No kidding," I thought. At first, I felt cheated when I saw she was a fake, but then I didn't mind. I really felt sorry for whoever was in that costume. I should be her friend, I thought. I could run away and join the circus and live with freaks, and they would accept me as the purple boy and be my friends. "You can ask her questions," the man in the white suit said. "She can predict the future." "When do I get my dollar back?" asked a wise guy. The alligator lady cocked her head and turned to glare at the man. "Listen," she said in an irritated tone, "I'm hot and sweaty, and this is the only job I could get, so give me a break." And unfortunately, this is where I'm going to have to stop today. I hope everyone enjoyed today's program as much as I did. I want to say hi to all the listeners out there, and I want to encourage everyone to tune in next week when I continue with the novel, Jack's New Power. Until then, I hope everyone has a great day and a fantastic week. So long and take care, everyone. Goodbye.